You actually have on your CV the first person to screen a film on the Coca-Cola billboard at Piccadilly Circus, a thing called the Ballet of Change. Clearly, you're already into a wonderful part of history and media stuff, etc. And when, of course, you're part of the representing homelessness attendees and you're attending the conference, etc., it's even more wonderful. And we're delighted to actually have a few words now with producer and managing director of Simple TV and Film Productions and Q&D Productions, both not-for-profit organisations, Q&D certainly. It's the awesome Paul Atherton. How are you, Paul?
I'm very well, sir. Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction.
Very important. Now, I've got to ask you, before we start talking about representing homelessness and so on, the billboard on Piccadilly Circus, I mean, it's almost... why hadn't it been done before?
Well, that's an easy one to answer, actually, because Coca-Cola sort of very nicely coined it when I actually approached Land Securities, who are the landlords for the site, that normally when people approach them, they just say, no, the landlord won't let us.
Yes.
Whereas I approached the landlord first, and the landlord said yes, and basically made Coke do it. But obviously one of the reasons for that was that we were talking about London history and capturing things about London history, and the billboard was the subject of the film. Mm-hmm. So Land Securities were very, very keen to keep their history and how important they've been and significant they've been to that landmark. So they basically just approached Coca-Cola and said, look, please work with this guy, and it worked out very effectively.
Fantastic. A Londoner's London. Look at your Twitter page here. You're in the top 1% for both at Local Guides and TripAdvisor UK reviews of London. The key word that comes across, Paul, is passionate. Passionate about the greatest city in the world.
I am. I'm very, very passionate about the greatest city in the world, and especially about its history, its culture, its people less so at the moment. I think we're not reflecting ourselves particularly well as a city when you consider that we invented charity as an idea back in 1742 with Thomas Coram's Foundling Hospital. That and before that, St. Bart's obviously was doing things in the 11th century. That actually with the homelessness issue that we now have, the attitude, and we've been talking this morning about the spikes and about the sort of anti-homelessness prevention things in commercial developments and the empty blocks of flats all along the Thames at the moment, which are these sort of iconic representations of ostentatious wealth, that we're not addressing fundamental problems and we're not doing the things that we are so well known for, which is having a community spirit, bringing ourselves together, supporting one another in the city. The city of London has always been about money and greed. And when you look at some of the reports, you know, when the city was first created with the South Sea Bubble, the language that they use, the yobbish language and the bans and things that the city traders used to have, hasn't changed in 300 years. But the rest of the city, the Westminster, the cathedral parts, the church parts, when you consider that, you know, we invented the Salvation Army, we came up with the YMCA, we came up with the Samaritans, you know, these are, and then the Peabodys and the Guinnesses and the Barnardos, of all of these organizations, philanthropic organizations, to find ourselves talking about homelessness in the 21st century, in, as you rightly point out, you know, one of the greatest capitals in the world, is I just find an embarrassment. I'm really hoping that this will be a kickstart to getting people effectively changing their thinking and engaging with the city and the people within the city in a much better way.
You've raised three key points there that I totally endorse in terms of it surely is unforgivable, and it's an unforgivable legacy should it become so, that when technology seems to be at an all-time high, where we actually have all these opportunities, that we can, you know, we're not actually ensuring that we are getting maximum benefits. I tend to go down to London two or three times a year. I was a student at London, a postgraduate student in London. I spent 7 years in the city, worked through that. So I do have a big affection for it, not so much as yourself, perhaps, but I think that probably be a different scale from that point of view. But it is noticeable that when I go there now, there is a kind of almost a, not a sense of despair, but a sense of unhappiness, a sense of difficulty. And as I said, that probably crosses over in terms of all sorts of things. I mean, is it a case of, you talked about a paradigm shift, a mind shift, which hopefully representing homelessness begins to trigger off. Is that ultimately we need to start getting together and start saying, okay, this is not acceptable. As you say, we're in the fourth largest economy in the world, and we should not be having this situation. I was shocked, actually, even in Lincoln, we have homeless people, and I think this is one of the areas that works through that. And, you know, homeless for not necessarily any fault of their own. I mean, that's the whole thing. There is this sense, dare I say, it may have come from different countries and so on, that actually, oh, you're homeless, oh, you must have done something wrong. Not necessarily.
Well, I mean, one of the key things for me, obviously, I've been homeless now for 10 years. And I've been through every initiative the government has thrown at it, and all of these things are designed and set up to move you from one place to another. So organizations get paid for referrals, not for curing the problem. Mm. So now we've created our own homeless industry where these organizations have lots of staff, and it's all about shifting and moving people. But if you look at, say, somewhere like Soho, and you've seen the rife consumerism in Soho, that, I believe, is the fundamental problem, is that we've shifted our attitude. You know, the consumerism is all king. Mm. And now we think, oh, buying things is better than living. So that we're not engaged with each other. I think, in addition to that, then we have the internet, which is incredibly isolating. You know, people are staring at their phones all day, being distracted by a million things and not having time to make that eye contact. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot all happening at one time that is allowing us this sort of alienation. And I think one of the things that I hate about what's happening to London at the moment is a disconnect between the younger generation and the history of London. So there's a lot of things being knocked down that people kind of shrug their shoulders about, whereas the older generation are kind of rallying, going, no, this is really important, because if that goes, that's it. Mm-hmm. And that connection you need with your history is an important part about going on in your future. And I think what London is at the moment, and I think you're right to mention the economy as well, I mean, the wealth in the city should never, ever permit this. You know, I mean, from my perspective, I'm developing an art project later in the year called Displace, which is basically all my possessions, 50 of what most people would consider the trappings of luxury. Mm. So my Savile Row suits, my John Lobb handmade shoes, you know, all these things that people would go, oh, well, you could only do that if you're successful. And the idea is that people go out and do this like a treasure hunt, but each object they find through the Smartify app will release a video of me explaining why I bought it, how long ago I bought it, the idea that this was never to be replaced, and, you know, it's just going to evolve. And the bottom line is that you engage with it in the way that you go, no, this, you know, let me find the answer to why you're homeless and continue to be homeless. And of course, the reality is they won't, because it's a system that's endemic that you can't break that's caused the problem.
Hmm. Okay, let's be positive. I mean, you suggested there's some ways in which new technology can be used to enhance and develop and grow the particular aspect. And people might be listening to this very interview/conversation via a mobile phone device and podcast and so on. Is there light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, is a case of we can actually say, yeah, by the time we get around to, say, 2040, 21 years from now, I mean, 5 years from now, we can actually say, yeah, a London is one in which people aren't homeless. We can almost have a declaration of a sort of citizens' residential home of rights, not just for London, but for all the other cities in the UK and the rural places as well.
I think there is a seismic move globally. I think you've got things like universal basic income being talked about for the first time. I think you've got an attitude to sharing. A sharing economy now is language that's often being used. But I think the really big difference is going to be is when people stop seeing value in property and start seeing homes again. And I genuinely believe we've got a generation of children who've taken to the streets for climate change, and I can see them doing exactly the same thing. So I'm incredibly optimistic about Gen Z coming through and kind of going, okay, we're not buying into consumerism, we want to save the planet, and as part of that, we're engaging as groups, so those groups are going to be supportive to one another. And at that point, I think you're going to see a complete different attitude to housing and property, and you know, we'll go back to pre-doomsday points, and instead of owning things, you'll just have it for the period of time that you want, and it'll get passed down to something else.
At Londoners London, presumably the best place to follow you on Twitter.
Absolutely, and A Londoners London on Instagram.
Excellent, always important. And how have you found the conference so far? I mean, we talked about some of the initial things there. I mean, I said to Owen, Katie, Nigel, and Peter, obviously, it's great that the thing is actually put together. British Academy obviously supporting it from that point of view. Here we are in Lincoln, what used to be actually back in the day, I believe, even bigger than London as far as a port was concerned for London. So
indeed,
it's an interconnection. Is it sort of living up to your expectations as a conference so far?
It's really interesting because, like, nearly everybody who's spoken today, Peter mentioned No Second Night Out, and I've had first-hand experience of that. Juliet was talking about Frank Bruno, who I celebrated on his 50th. But Owen was talking about magazines and things, and John Bird and I clash over the big issue. So it's been a really interesting, especially for me, because I don't come from an academic background. So being in a conference that is fundamentally an academic conference, but bringing in, because there's a number of people here who are in the same situation as I am, who are homeless. Sure. And we're all saying the same thing. The number of times that organizations have been held about homelessness and there hasn't been a single homeless person in the room. It's good to be in that situation where we're here.
And I think you've raised another very important point there, which is vital, because I know there are folk who understandably are skeptical, saying, oh yes, that's just a bunch of academics talking in their ivory towers about, oh, how fascinating this is. And I think actually the line which has been very much consistent through that is to ensure that participant observation is much a part of the whole thing as everything else.
Absolutely.
Paul, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. I'll let you get back to your lunch now in many ways. So it's great stuff there. I remind it's at Londoners London, or indeed a Londoners London, for another way forward from that point of view. And we look forward to more fantastic product from you in the very near future.
Thank you very much.
Continuing the wonderful connection of people who've been involved with the Representing Homelessness Conference and have actually been attending, we're delighted now to actually speak to a documentary filmmaker and participatory video facilitator based in Glasgow, who was inspired using the participatory video method when she realised how powerful people's stories are when told by themselves. Berlin-born, of course, an Edinburgh-based visual storyteller, is the wonderful Sabine Hellman. How are you, Sabine?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Now, one of the things that has already struck me as very important was this project you were involved with for Pact Uganda. Would you like to share with us a little bit about what you did with that?
Yes, sure. So with Pact Uganda, we worked with a group of reformed warriors, people that were involved in the conflict, cattle herders that were, because of the droughts and the environmental pressures, trying to steal cattle. And with the introduction of guns, these battles were obviously bloody and horrible for the whole community. But the government intervened with an interesting project where they not just only took away the guns and put them in prison, but actually did psychological interventions and went through a trauma healing process. Now, this is really difficult to quantify. Like, how did that go? Was it successful? So we came in as a facilitator and made a project with them to tell their stories of change, to see whether this trauma healing component of the project actually worked.
On an international level, of course, that's something which is very much at the heart of how these developing. I mean, the conference, of course, is Representing Homelessness and so on. We were talking a few moments ago to Paul Atherton, and he had his particular sort of take in terms of how things are operating, obviously, as a London-based filmmaker from that point of view. This has kind of moved it into the international area. And again, is that something which the way in which you're presenting this? I mean, I've also been involved with training community members at a green energy project in the Ukraine, so genuine international. Is that something which clearly kind of resonates with your own personal beliefs in terms of how things are going? How actually, in the 21st century, it's a line we've used several times before, and we'll use it again. This is actually unacceptable for people to actually be without no fixed abode.
You know? Yes. And I think what's really important is that their voices need to be heard, because we don't really understand what are these different routes, and they're so diverse. What happened to people that they became homeless? It's not, you know, just, oh yeah, because he's a drunk. No, it's not. Mm. There's so many different reasons, and we need to listen to the people themselves, not just, you know, to the newspapers.
Also sharing some thoughts with us today are the official conference tweeter on behalf of Signet PR. It's the wonderful Emma Street. I think a nice surname Street and a homeless sort of aspect there. It's good. It's yeah. Works perfectly. Emma, how have you found the conference so far?
It's been really interesting, actually, the conference so far. You know, we've had the discussion and debates over newspapers and how they've represented homeless people in the media, which has always been a topic that I've been quite interested in, really. How newspapers and the media represent certain types of people. So I think that's been quite interesting. And when people are asking questions and you hear comments from different types of people from different areas of life, it really brings it makes it real, I think, when you're in those sorts of situations.
Sabine, the notion of participatory, I mean, it's something which I seem to recall the Glasgow Media Group back in the 1960s were actually talking about, and 70s and so on, following through that. With the ease of technology, is it becoming easier for people to actually create their own stories and develop their own stories But at the same time, getting an awareness of that story being told sometimes can be a challenge. It's okay making it, but how do you distribute it?
Yeah, that's a big point. And it does become easier, but often people even lack the confidence to think that their voice is important to be shared. Mm-hmm. And to share them, obviously, also you need a certain network, you need data, you need to figure out where you the channels where you can share these things too. So we always try to help people to organize their own community screenings, to engage with the people that might be stakeholders or you know, people involved that could change things. And that's why the screenings itself are a really great way to do that. But then with YouTube, you can also just go online and try to get people to do that. And even with farmers in Malawi who can share these films, small files on their phone via Bluetooth. So not even using data and the internet, but actually just changing it phone to phone. And that's how stories can spread in these days.
John Grierson, of course, a Scottish gentleman known as the father of modern documentary filmmaking, I think would be quite impressed with the way things have actually changed since he was very passionately committed in the 30s and the late 20s to effectively tell this story, influenced by Robert Flaherty and so on. Are there any documentary filmmakers who've influenced yourself? I mean, are you a Michael Moore fan? Would you turn around and say, yeah, actually, this is where we're looking for in terms of the way forward?
One of my favorite filmmakers is Kim Longinotto, who is doing amazing work working with community members whose stories need to be heard. A lot of women's stories that have not come to the fore as much, but through her amazing work, I love her. It's amazing. And there's so many other filmmakers out there. A lot of documentary filmmakers I like, but she's still my favorite.
And as opposed to the days of the early documentarians where people had to physically go to a cinema to see these things or to have a special room and screening for them, as you've already alluded to, technology has made it slightly easier. Is it sometimes confusing as well, though, for people who sometimes sort of think, oh, where do we go with this? And it's all, it's, I mean, you know, it's all right for Emma. She's got everything sorted out. But what about, you know, the latest sort of update, etc.?
Yeah, I think that's quite hard. And even I struggle with it sometimes. You know, even I have some films sitting somewhere that haven't made it to YouTube yet. And it's, I think it's really important to look at that with a group that does something to help them, where can it go, and make a strategy even, and help them to really figure out, look, we need to reach this audience, how do we best reach them, and this is what we can do. And a lot of these things are free these days, so.
Which is always good. SabineHellman.com, of course, is a wonderful website to go to actually find out further details. What have you found out from yourself? I mean, we're kind of quarter of the way through the conference now, halfway through day one, and obviously we will probably do follow-up pieces afterwards. Has it been as expected? Has it exceeded your expectations? Is it better? What are your thoughts?
So far, it's been really interesting, especially seeing the media comparisons, what's been reported, and seeing also the people engaging with it. I've been already talking to a few people. It's really great, and I'm really looking forward to more of that. The Museum of Homelessness came up, and I'm really interested to see that. There's a performance, and of course our film tonight that I hope a lot of people will come to see too.
Sure, it'd be absolutely awesome. And I've got to ask the question, given your Scottish Germanic roots from that point of view, is Germany in a similar condition when it comes to homelessness? Is it a challenge from that point of view, or is it a case of no, as ever, the Germans have got themselves sorted out?
Unfortunately, I'm not too much in touch with what's going on. But every time I am in Germany, I do feel there is still a big problem out there. You do come across more of it, and it's more visible these days. But I don't understand whether there is policy in place or what's being done at the moment.
Emma, any final thoughts or thoughts for Sabine?
I just wondered, like, where do you find, you know, the inspiration, or how did you get started with this whole project?
Now, this project was started by a colleague of mine in Oxford, and because she lived there, it was a visible thing. And then the two organizations that came on board to do something, Aspire Oxford and Oxford Homeless Pathways, they were faced with these severe funding cuts in 2015. And they said, we need to put a story out there that there are services people can go to. They're really important. We can't lose these essential services to help people out of homelessness. And that's when they came together and said, let's make a film, but not just us going out and do it, but let's get the people involved that are actually, you know, going through this at the moment.
which I suppose is the essence of participatory filmmaking in many ways. Sabine, it's been awesome making some contact with your good self. As I said, sabinehellman.com is a good place to go to. Any other socials you'd like to sort of promote as well, the Facebook and such like?
Well, I would love to say that you should definitely check out some of the projects InsideShare has been doing. So insideshare.org is a great place to start, and you'll see lots of great work. And we also have a YouTube channel, so you can see many participatory videos on there.
And so we reach the third of our trilogy of fabulous contributors to the Representing Homelessness and indeed delegates. We spoke, of course, to Paul Atherton, Sabine Hellman, and we're now delighted to welcome Professor Susan Phillips from Pfizer College in the joys of Claremont, United States of America, of course.
That's right, California.
Exactly. So you've made the journey over from West Coast through East Coast over to Lincoln, England, on our own East Coast. And what are your thoughts, Susan, so far on the Representing Homelessness event?
Well, it's such a delight to be here. I mean, it's unusual for me. I would never, of course, would have visited Lincoln, much less the University of Lincoln.
Nebraska, perhaps.
Right, exactly. Well, not even there. Oh. But without a kind of wonderful excuse, which is this conference to come. And so far, we've only had the morning sessions, but it's been an eye-opener for me. It actually has sort of driven home how incredibly different it is in the United States, and how, particularly in California, particularly in Los Angeles, which is where I live, how incredibly dire the situation is there, and how different the discourses are similar between our discussions about homelessness and how to treat, you know, root causes versus symptoms and what that balance looks like, you know, othering discourses, who is included in the discussion, who isn't. And there's some similarities, obviously, I think, across the board. The similarities people haven't talked about, I think, are things that have to do with global capital and neoliberalism and all these different forces that are changing, you know, conditions, not just locally, but everywhere, or impacting multiple people at a local level. But the differences are striking. So
it's interesting in terms of that whole notion of the global situation, the state of humanity. And one of the common themes that has come across from these short discussions has been that surely it's unacceptable for conceivably the first and fourth biggest economies in the world to have such a significant proportion of the population that are actually without homes, and not through choice, but through a whole range of aspects within that. Now, clearly, we can go back historically and see situations with respect to the Great Depression, issues relating to the 1930s and so on. But there is somehow a kind of a cognitive disconnect between technology is there, 21st century is there, affluence is actually there, and yet why is this? Why is this occurring? Is it a case of, you know, I suppose you could say almost the glamour of the hobo sometimes comes to mind, really, but it's actually, and you cited Los Angeles, we have several contacts with Los Angeles, filmmakers as well, and it seems almost inconceivable that you have on the one hand a dream capital of the world there with the industry and so on, and yet on the other hand, an awful lot of people who might be chasing their dreams, etc., who are in dire straits.
Yeah, it's from my perspective, I guess, and many people's, part of the condition of today is this sort of, when you have the one extreme, which is the dreams and the wealth, you also increase the other extreme, which is the sort of direness. So there can't be. It seems like we can't reach the non-zero sum game. We have to have winners and losers, and the extremes that separate them seem to be growing more distant. So that's kind of, and one of, and what I'm going to be presenting about is about Skid Row in Los Angeles, which I know has been in the news media here in the UK, simply because of how dire it is there. It's like a living nightmare in Skid Row right now. With trash and rats, it's almost medieval, and I'm saying this in the heart of a medieval city, but it's really quite a different phenomenon, even as distinguished from the 90s. So in the US, we didn't have chronic homelessness before the 1980s, and it was a lot of, again, it was economic restructuring, deindustrialization. In Los Angeles, we had in California, we had deinstitutionalization of mental health, And that put a lot of people on the streets. They closed. And there was just a closure and shrinkage of public services. And that seems to be a common factor, I think, across multiple locations when you end up creating the situation where private investment becomes the norm and the expectation and the desire rather than public investment in the public good. And so there's nowhere it gets played out, I think, more visibly than in the ranks of housing.
And in terms of, again, return to the title of the conference, Representing Homelessness, is the media often guilty of perhaps either glamorizing or sort of, actually worse than glamorizing, positioning as the other, the sort of notion of the fear? So actually we become, as human beings, just a little bit afraid, a little bit concerned when we might be approached by somebody who's homeless in the street or somebody who's actually disconnected, that somehow they almost become invisible to us. I mean, you can go back to the Good Samaritan in the Bible from that point of view to actually say these things are actually happening and we need to address them.
Yeah. No, I think that the media has a huge role to play. Although this morning we heard that the media in the UK is more likely to have recognized not just personal failings, but structural ones. And I'm curious in the UK in particular whether measures such as austerity, which seems to be linked to the rise in homelessness, is something that has touched everybody in the UK. And so maybe they can relate a little bit more to how it could actually shove someone from being housed to being without a house or without roofless, I think they like to call it sometimes. Certainly the media has a role to play. One of the things that I'm presenting on is actually graffiti written by homeless people. Part of the problem with media representations is that they often don't include representations that homeless people make for themselves. And so one of the things that I'm doing is presenting a little bit about that as it happens on Skid Row in Los Angeles.
Mm. And we're having this conversation, and the conference is taking place 50 years more or less to the day since Neil Armstrong was on his way to planting his first footprints on the moon. If we look ahead 50 years from now, is this something which we're still going to be talking about, or is there a case of these kind of events can actually do more than just be perceived as, oh, that's a bunch of academics talking about representing homelessness? I mean, one of the great strengths, I think, of this conference that I've noted is you actually have genuine people who've experienced homelessness here, not in a kind of, that's a very interesting notion to actually go through, but is that a way of actually triggering off really the start of a consciousness and a raising consciousness, a shifting consciousness to say, actually, we can address these issues?
Yeah, I think we actually have the tools to address them already. What we lack is the political will. I also think that you're right when, you know, the old adage that the people closest to the problem are the people closest to the solution. And the more conversations we have, and this conference is a good example of it, that bridge between the academy and people who are directly impacted by an issue, I think the better off we'll be. When you ask the question about 50 years from now, I actually got chills thinking about it because I'm from the perspective of what is happening in Los Angeles right now.
2069.
I have such a lack of hope about it. And truly, in 50 years, it would be lovely to project a positive image of having gone forward. But my sense is that we're moving in the wrong direction and that the forces that are generating homelessness are generating them faster than we can keep up to solve them. And they're so big. Nobody knows how they work. They're impossible to touch. Unless we can tackle those and literally restructure capital, which is a really difficult thing to even envision, I don't think that we're going to gain much momentum. I think a small cities, a city like Lincoln, I think that this is the place. These are the types of places where you can enact solutions that are humane and inclusive. And this is the type of place I see the most hope. The major cities, I think, are so unwieldy. It's really hard to envision what that would look like for me.
I suppose given the notion that we do have one of the rare copies of the Magna Carta in Lincoln, which of course was the foundation for the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of and Rights, etc., maybe actually there's some symmetry in terms of that. Maybe we can actually lead forward. And just a little rejoinder for Professor Susan Phillips from Pitzer College. Of course, we've got the... that's in pizza, really. I'm thinking
that's
it's
right.
pizza. You have some wonderful text coming through, including a book on graffiti, which we'd like to just mention.
Yes, it's coming out at the end of November 2019. It's called The City Beneath, A Century of Los Angeles Graffiti, and published with Yale University Press. And it does touch on these issues as they go back 100 years to hobos, tramps, and itinerant workers, and moves all the way through the 20th century, including some of the stuff that I'll be talking about on Skid Row.